What is the potential as well as peril when NGOs move to a network structure? Over the years, some nonprofits and NGOs have adopted ever more ambitious and complex organizational structures. Federated structures, confederated ones, and some have chosen network structures. Now, civil society has always known loose networks of independent organizations that primarily exchange information with each other and sometimes engage in loose joint campaigns. But lately, the network structure seems to be more in vogue. Why is that? Why is it felt as an imperative by some? Why as more democratic, as a good form of power sharing, etc.? What is the promise of such network structures? And what is their peril? Do networks that have to do much more than information sharing and loose joint campaigning, those that actually have to co-decide, co-manage, co-lead, co-implement, do these fall prey to what somebody once called the tyranny of structurelessness? Can these networks provide sufficient clarity as well as agility of decision-making, accountability, distribution of authority and decision rights, dispersal of tasks, and transparency? And to what extent might they perhaps exacerbate the already pernicious internal navel-gazing that I see some NGOs suffer from? That is the set of questions I put in front of Doris Basler, until recently the Director for Strategy and Confederation Development at Oxfam International, about Oxfam's aspiration to be what it calls a diversified network. And one side note, though very important, I want to also give a special shout out to some of my audience members who recently gave me very useful feedback. They told me both what they valued about my podcast and where I can still improve. I am grateful to them because they allow me to keep learning. Now, let's get on with the show. Hello, and welcome to NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye. My name is Tosca Bruno van Vijveken, and I'm the founder and principal consultant at Five Oaks Consulting. I have over three decades of experience helping leaders in civil society manage change, invest in cutting-edge leadership development, lead organizational culture change, and strengthen effectiveness. I'm also a thought leader on these issues, including as co-author of the book Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs, which is read by civil society leaders across the globe. If you are such a leader and want to look change right in the eye, this podcast is for you. Hello, everybody. This is Tosca at NGO Soul and Strategy. This episode, we're going to talk about organizational structures and models that some NGOs have opted for. And we're going to work really hard to not make it boring. It's going to be interesting. I promise you that. There are a number of organizational structures out there that NGOs have chosen over the years. Many started out by what we call in the academic literature as unitary corporate structures. So these are your classical organizational models with their headquarters, and in the case of an NGO, with country or regional entities that are line managed by a global center, a headquarters, and that have typically one global board. Then you have some NGOs that have opted to be federated or confederated organizational structures. So where you have separate autonomous entities that are legally registered in their own countries. And without getting too technical and therefore boring, the amount of the difference between federated and confederated structures, amongst others, has to do with the amount of power, control, decision rights, and authority that these autonomous members have been willing to yield to the center.
or secretariat or whatever it's called. In the case of federations, that's a bit more yielding of power to a center than in the case of confederated organizations. And you also see some network organizational structures in a sector. And these are much more, they have chosen to be much, much loosely aligned. They are often completely separate organizations that do share information, some resources with each other, and they often coordinate action. These days, amongst the mid to larger size INGOs, networks seem to be increasingly attractive. At the same time, feminist leadership as a leadership model or approach is also on the rise. So what I'm asking in this podcast interview, why is this the case? What's the potential of organizations that aspire to become more networked organizations? What of these aspirations have been realized so far, and what are the inevitable trade-offs, or at least polarities, that those NGOs who've chosen this model need to manage? That is the question of this episode, and that was a long introduction. And I am going to interview today Doris Basler, who until about 5-6 months ago was the Director for Strategy as well as Feminist Futures, as well as the Director for Strategy and Confederation Development at Oxfam International. You should know that she left that role in December of last year and is currently, as she says so well on LinkedIn, she is taking a career pause, resting, learning, and volunteering. So I'm asking Doris to look back on her experience at Oxfam. So Doris, you're so welcome.
Hi, Tosca. Thanks for having me back. It's always such a great opportunity to exchange with you, and through you to also exchange with the many people you interact with. So really looking forward to the conversation.
I am too. And I know, and you know, that it's not a boring topic at all. It's actually quite fascinating once you get beyond the formal side of it. So let me introduce Doris's bio. As I said, she's resting, learning, and volunteering in Berlin, Germany. That is well-deserved after, I am sure, long years with lots of long hours at Oxfam. And even before that, she was also the Director for Organizational Development Services at Transparency International, the Head of Capacity Services at Transparency. She has worked at the Minds Advisory Group, and she has been in a number of roles with the International Committee for the Red Cross. So Doris, let's dive in. How can you describe for a general audience how the organizational structure of Oxfam has evolved over time, from what to what and why?
Great. Let me try and unpack that in a way that makes sense. So Oxfam would describe itself as what you named as a confederation in its current state. But let me start a little bit with the history, especially for those maybe who are not so familiar with Oxfam. So it all started back in 1942, where actually in Great Britain at the time, an organization was established that then became Oxfam Great Britain. The name at the time initially was the Oxford Committee for Famine Relief. And then inspired by that, in a couple of other countries, similar organizations came into being. But it was not until much later, I think it was 1995, where 8 or 9 national Oxfam organizations decided to also come together in an international network that since then has expanded to, I think, currently 21 national affiliates. And the confederated structure, I think, was chosen to get the most out of that independence and value add of nationally registered organizations that are really grounded in their own contexts and that also are accountable in their own contexts. And yet to work with the famous, the sum can be greater than its parts, of coming together to also pursue the vision and the mission at an international and ultimately worldwide and global level. So mm-hmm. 1995, Oxfam International was established as that confederation, which has since grown. The reason for the growth, I think, was very much driven then also by the ambition that was expressed in the previous strategic plan to become a worldwide influencing network. And that really contributed to what I often refer to as a magic triangle in terms of the work that Oxfam was doing globally. On the one hand, engaging on development, as we like to call it, also a very important role in the humanitarian sector and humanitarian relief, but always already with that ambition of really also bringing about political change. So advocacy, influencing, and what now the current strategic framework would very strongly center on system change. And to become what the previous strategy called a worldwide influencing network, I think clearly came with a recognition to actually do that, to be relevant in those different contexts, to have that influence at national, at regional, and also at global level, benefited from that kind of structure that basically somewhat sits in between, if you think of a spectrum between an organizational structure that is incredibly centralized, where you have like a hub and spoke network, if you think social network analysis, but also not something that is entirely decentralized, very loose, and where you don't have that coordination capacity that ultimately, in the form of the Oxfam International Secretariat, has really allowed Oxfam to capitalize on that ability to create change at all those different levels, including at the global level.
Okay.
And to speak with one voice.
Okay. So you have described what that model is like. Let's jump immediately to the questions, not just based on what it might look on picture, but in reality, you've lived that experience, right? And in a very central role that was explicitly about, amongst others, your confederated model. What are the strengths of a confederation and what are its inherent weaknesses and limitations?
Yeah, let me start by acknowledging that the model of Oxfam, that confederated model, is quite complex at different levels. But I also would like to say that complexity in itself is not inherently or necessarily negative, as long as you acknowledge and you understand that complexity. And part of that understanding is that it's also its complexity at different levels. It's complexity in terms of the areas of work that an INGO is doing. It can be complexity in terms of the membership. It can be complexity in terms of funding flows, in terms of operating models. So there's almost complex complexity. And I would say that Oxfam is probably in that space. So the confederated model, again, I think it is a real opportunity to not get stuck on one or the other side of the spectrum. And actually, when Oxfam went through its global governance reform over the last couple of years, we were in a phase where we really seemed stuck in that discussion of what are we or what do we want to be? Do we want to be a confederation or a federation? And then the facilitator who worked with us at the time actually helped us take a step back and realize that in today's world, which is also so complex, but also so constantly shifting and so uncertain and so sometimes unpredictable, that actually thinking in those either or dichotomies is not helpful. And actually, at the time of the governance reform, we realized that we could go around and around and around discussing that question. But actually, the challenge for Oxfam was to identify and then to respond to the fact of where, committed to the concept of a confederation as a structure that allows both independence and coherence, and coherence also meaning interdependence, so allowing independence and interdependence, but that there is no one size fits all, or that cannot be static. So maybe on some areas, there are opportunities for Oxfam or other organizations of becoming more united or more centralized, because that would serve its purpose better. Whereas maybe at the same time, there are other areas in its work or in how it works where moving towards a looser way of working with each other would benefit more. Mm. And if I were to put two examples on that, this was also the time where still the sector was grappling with the challenges in terms of safeguarding, in terms of that area of work. Now, that was something where also external stakeholders expected cohesion within an organization. Mm. The donors are not interested, ultimately, whether they are speaking to a headquarters or a country office or whatever. Donors expect compliance with yeah. a certain set of standards across an organization, across all its different types of presence. So that is an area where also probably in terms of effectiveness for an organization being more federated in the sense of all agreeing to the same system structures, policies makes a lot of sense. Whereas if you think of futures thinking, of horizon scanning, of innovation, a very centralized model would probably not do you any service, because how would you be able to actually feel where the tectonic plates are shifting, but also just see what's happening underneath if you don't create those spaces?
So are you saying, Doris, that basically in the latest iteration of Oxfam, discussions about and then choices made, Oxfam wanted to have the capability to be on different parts of this spectrum between more centralized, as in a relatively centralized, as in a federated structure, and much more loosely, as in a very loose version of a confederate, that you wanted to have that versatility to slide across that spectrum. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was recognized as important, because otherwise in today's world, if you remain static in your organizational thinking and structure in a world that basically is no longer static or probably never has been, you're missing out. So I think that commitment to a confederation is basically something that sits on that spectrum relatively in the middle, so that allows for that more independent work of parts of the system where that serves your purpose and your impact. But that also creates the space to actually come together more closely. The confederated model provides you with that opportunity. And then, of course, it's, every organization then has its own history, has its own organizational life cycle, has its shocks or its triggers. And in Oxfam, coming back a little bit to that question, where has Oxfam come from? Where is it? And what is its aspiration? Like other INGOs or other organizations, in principle, probably there's been a cycle of quite transformational change processes in Oxfam. There was a period in Oxfam, for example, in the early days, where work in countries was really led and managed by national Oxfam affiliates. Mm-hmm. So you could have a country where there might have been up to 5, 6, 7, 9 Oxfam affiliates, all present with a country program, a country office, yeah. et cetera. That was the early days. That was recognized as not being efficient, of not serving the impact that Oxfam wanted to have. So that was an important major transition for the organization to actually say, well, that work in countries where Oxfam is not represented through a national affiliate will actually come under the management of Oxfam International. That right. was a massive shift. And then with that shift came some other reform processes, like a previous governance reform that at the time changed Oxfam's governance structures, but in a way that enabled these other changes to happen, that enabled the trust to be there with national affiliates acknowledging there was a big change for them in how the organization was operating. But they knew that at the time, through the governance structure as it was redesigned, they were not suddenly cut off everything, but they were still connected to that.
Yeah.
The what's now, and we'll come to the diversified network.
Yes, I was going to ask
what it actually means, etc. But the commitment to global balance, that was a previous key theme in Oxfam, and it remains very important. That was born, I would say, or maybe not born, but for the first time clearly expressed in 2015. So quite a long time ago. And again, it connected to that concept of a worldwide influencing network, and how can actually be an international NGO be relevant and be resilient and be impactful in that way.
Got it. And if I may just interject for one moment for our audience, so when we talk about global balance, we in simple terms mean that some NGOs, and Oxfam being one, wanted to balance the representation of members from Global South, Global East, and Global North, and no longer be dominated by Global North members. Just wanted to offer that to our audience.
That was a key component of it. The concept was actually broader than that. The concept really also expanded to the voice that Oxfam wants to speak with, wants to be a globally balanced voice. So that, for example, how does Oxfam more interact with global movements? So it was actually beyond just that membership component. But which was then prioritized because at the time, I think in 2015, don't quote me in case I'm not getting the figures exactly right, but it was probably two or three affiliates in what we often refer to as the Global South, and all other national Oxfams were still in the Global North. You would only have had Oxfam Mexico, Oxfam India, and then Oxfam Hong Kong kind of also outside of the Europe, North America. So it was felt that definitely in terms of Oxfam's decision-making, for example, who is in the room, who decides on strategy, who has influence on that level, that it was important to start by shifting that balance in the membership in terms of the national affiliates.
Got it.
And there's been good progress made since then. And the diversified network has really evolved out of that in terms of global balance in the membership, and the diversified network thinking was then a further iteration of that.
So then I'm going to now ask you to pin that down a little bit more. So is the term, we have the aspiration to be in a diversified network, how is that different from or greater specification of being a globally balanced confederated organization? What else is in that definition?
I think the focus of the initial global balance commitment was, as we said, on a somewhat quantitative balancing of the numbers of affiliates in the confederation. So moving from 2 or 3 and 15 to, well, a balance at some point, which would possibly mean same number of affiliates in the South as affiliates in the North.
Right.
It was, I think, implied and assumed that would mean greater diversity of voice. And there were also in then the early decisions of the countries where Oxfam was then reaching out to either build a new affiliate or to invite an organization to become an affiliate, there was specific thinking on how that would diversify voice. So were there countries with a priority non-Christian population? Were there, if you think Africa, trying to really reflect a bit the size of Oxfam's programs in that region and therefore recognizing that it was important to also build national affiliates in Africa? There were considerations of language. Oxfam was a very Anglophone confederation in its early days, like many other organizations emanating from the North. So those diversity considerations were there. But then I think as these processes happened with Oxfam South Africa, Oxfam Brazil, KEDEF in Turkey, and now others coming on board, it was also partly learning by doing. And it was interesting to see in terms of what was Oxfam looking for in those new affiliates. And there were many discussions and a lot of criticism for quite some time, whether this was just an exercise of creating mini-me's, as Oxfam called it, and maybe
Very
others.
Good
so that actually, almost a bit like when you recruit staff, like a recruitment bias, you tend to recruit people who are a bit like you because they make you feel safe.
Yeah.
So going into those countries and then balancing that, what did Oxfam, what did the Confederation feel they need it, and what did the stakeholders in the country want to contribute and offer. I think that was a mutual learning process. And then that comes to the interesting question of how much courage does it take to become more diverse? And when that term diversified network was coined, and I think that was in 2020 only specifically, there was some work in between which didn't use that term, but which was starting to reflect then also on the question of is it, in terms of diversity of voice and of perspective, is it actually about different types of association with Oxfam also? So should Oxfam only think about growing the number of affiliates, or should Oxfam consider other types of being connected to Oxfam, but without having that membership status? Or was it also about diversity in affiliate business models? And that's where those questions came in of, like, is it about mini-me's? Is every affiliate expected to work across those areas, development, humanitarian, and political advocacy?
I see.
Or is every affiliate expected to raise enough funds to be at least self-sustainable? Or is every affiliate expected to be called Oxfam country name, like Oxfam Great Britain? And so there were a couple of issues, and I think they got richer and richer as we engaged with more and more countries. In terms of, like, yeah, what does diversity mean? Is diversity an opportunity or a risk? How much learning and unlearning is there involved? And once there was even a situation where there was a potential project to partner with another organization, and Oxfam was very clear about what it liked about that other organization and the kind of how that other organization was different from itself. And at the same time, and in the end, it didn't happen. At the same time, there were people who said, "Well, but so we're valuing that difference, that new thing that this organization would bring." And at the same time, we're already talking as if the organization would have to let go of all of that because they would have to fit within our way of doing things as Oxfam. So that for me was quite an interesting light bulb moment, actually. In terms of, like, it's a stretch goal. Diversity, I think, is a stretch goal also for an organization, really. But let me pause here and.
Yeah. But that was a very interesting answer. I'm glad we discussed it that way. Now, whether we stick to the term confederated structured, which is still the legal form, right, of the organization, or whether we call it diversified network, the way you've just elaborated on it. It's easy. I'm going to ask you to say, what are the, from an ideal perspective, the principles, the values, right? What you're trying to signal either symbolically or politically. It's easy to imagine what is attractive about a confederation or a diversified network, right? You said already diversity of view, richness of views, more holistic perspective, not just from a global north center, not just white normed, etc. It leads to greater power balancing, presumably, although we know that that continues to be a very contentious topic and a long road. There are democratic ideals that are encapsulated in it. I can see all those as very positive things. However, I do have to ask the question, how has it worked out so far, that aspiration of being a diversified network?
I think it is a work in progress or process. I never know how to say that in a proper English way.
Both are good.
And I also actually want to say that for me, it's, and that is partly a personal view maybe, but after 20 years in the sector and you know, having worked with these different organizations, personally, I think it is not a nice to have, but it is an imperative. Again, in today's world, in a world where clearly power is shifting, and rightly so. I think diversification in different ways, it is essential for organizations. I do not believe they would survive without that, and I don't think they should have a right to survive. But that also means that clarity of purpose is very important nevertheless, of like, start with the why, keep going back to the why. Don't just do it as a and now again, I'm missing a bit the English language, but don't just do it to look good, right? Or don't just talk about it so that you look good. You really have to be, and also then to create that common commitment to it, and to allow the different parts of the network to actually go along and be champions. You have to be clear on the why. And if you're a social impact organization, I would argue the I is always about that impact. And with Oxfam, we then often framed it as we need to be relevant across many different contexts. That will help make us resilient. Mm. And then as a resilient organization, that is how we can continue to be impactful and meaningful in the future. Mm-hmm. And linked to that, I also think it is really essential that if you have that clarity of purpose as an intrinsic motivation almost, that you understand that that will very probably require systems change in your own organization and you as part of the sector. So we advocate so much for systems change in the world. As I said, the global strategic framework of Oxfam is entirely built around that and intersectional approaches to systems change. But we also have to recognize that even those discussions on global balance, on diversity or diversified networks, we're having them within institutional frameworks and within decision-making structures that still very much privilege certain forms of knowledge and expertise, and that have been designed, of course, from a different perspective. So that, I just think, is fundamental to create an opportunity for success, that clarity of purpose and that clarity on and commitment to system change, which rarely comes without pain, but which is so important.
Yeah, okay. You make a very clear case, and as you take a strong stance on that, comes with pain. Yeah, so let me ask you a follow-up question, and I'm partially being provocative, but I have to say it has crossed my mind sometimes as I observe the sector and I observe leaders in action as well as how they talk about leadership. Oxfam already was a complex organization by the very fact of the legal structure and the number of members, etc. Then on top of that, all the aspirations around diversified network, right? All the values and principles behind that. And then feminist leadership over on top of that. I mean, I'm simplifying, but you get the drift. Do you think that managers and leaders in an organization like Oxfam have the capacity to manage that very complexity? Yeah, let me start there.
I think that there's definitely moments where one feels overwhelmed. And again, also you mentioned the many different, be it change processes or be it aspirations or commitments that Oxfam and other organizations have made. And I certainly clearly remember moments, be it during the global strategy process, which I co-led, being during the global governance reform that I was very engaged with, where suddenly we almost came to a standstill because there was that anxiety of there is too much change already happening, and we're not on top of it, and we're, you know, let's rather do one piece of change, try and do it well, and then we move on to other pieces of change. And again, that's between a rock and a hard place, because on the one hand, yes, I mean, you need to make sure, especially as leaders in an organization, that again, you create the trust, the confidence also, that the safe environment for your staff, for your stakeholders to actually be part of that change. And at the same time, that consecutive thinking is probably also not working out, because by the time you then possibly have finished one change, if you ever finish change, already, you know, you probably have to start it again because something else has changed. And so you just have to have that courage again to jump into the cold water sometimes and just say, okay, part of that is, again, that ability to navigate, to first accept and embrace uncertainty, to navigate in a way that feels your stakeholders are as safe as possible, but nevertheless, to play those different things at the same time. Are managers in INGOs sufficiently well equipped? It's interesting because I just read an article.
Let me just clarify the question maybe a little bit more. Are they sufficiently equipped to benefit from the advantages of the model and to manage the polarities and the trade-offs and sometimes the real weaknesses that are also built into that choice of model?
Yeah. No, that's really a very good question. And as you know, maybe starting at a quite basic level, also many people who are managers in organizations such as Oxfam, our original background is we've been activists, or maybe we've been lawyers, but it's not necessarily we don't come with an MBA, don't come with change management degrees. Exactly. We come possibly from a different background, and then over time, we evolve into that management responsibility, where then also once you're at that level in an organization, indeed, I think that complexity and the more complex the structure, the more you are caught up in just trying to manage that structure, right?
Yes.
So you still want to do your program specialist work or your lawyer work or your activist work to some degree. But actually, the more complex the structure, the more time is invested in either managing or let alone changing that structure.
Yeah.
But I think that's where, and that's certainly, and that requires also a broad skill set, right? So you have to be the diplomat, possibly if you're in one meeting room, and then you have to actually be the activist in another room, and then you have to be the mediator in the third room, and then I don't think there is enough scope or enough investment in that continuous learning process for managers in those organizations, in most probably, because it's shifting, and I assume it would be the same in the corporate world and wherever. Just the expectations, and the article that I read earlier today was actually saying a bit exactly that, also in terms of the how to lead, right? Oxfam and many other organizations has feminist principles, has clearly expressed values, does a lot of training around all of that. And yet that how can you actually be an empathetic leader? How can you be a feminist leader? It's still at risk of sometimes falling between the cracks.
And looking at the time, I realized that, there's so much more that I'd want to respond to and ask you, but I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm going to just leave one question, not for you to answer, but maybe for all of us to ponder. I am no longer certain that it's even possible humanly, as well as bureaucratically or process-wise or operationally, to draw the benefits from that level of complexity, while, as I said, mitigating at the very least the polarities, if not the downsides. I am just sometimes wondering if we as a sector are overreaching. But that's a question. I'm not sure about that. I certainly don't know the answer to it, but I am somewhat concerned about that question. You did mention already and you said it, in fact, very nicely. You said we are caught up in the complexity of the complex structures and the amount of attention span that has to go to that and actual time that then is drawn away from the work to amplify the work of rights holders, to be externally oriented, to be impacting through influencing, et cetera, other actors in global governance that we want to influence. I am also increasingly worried about that. But what I now want to ask you, maybe my last substantive question, how do you think that the confederated model and within that the aspiration of diversified network impacts the quality of decision making? Where does it increase the quality, and where might it actually challenge the quality of decision making, let alone the adaptiveness and responsiveness of decision making?
in general, I would be a strong advocate for it meaning a confederated model or a model where really diversity is at the center. I would be a strong advocate for that. It enhances the quality of the decision making. Because simply, again, if there's just one person thinking about a solution, they may or may not come up with the right solution. If you have a diversity of voices, of perspectives, the process might be challenging at times, but as long as it is anchored in what in Oxfam we often then call the core or the organizational fundamentals, as long as there is a collective sense of belonging that's captured and with regards to the vision and the mission and the values of the organization, and that common focus of we are here to deliver that purpose, we are here because we want to create this kind of social impact, I think ultimately at the end of the day, it might be less straight a line. It might be that you're doing a few more curves or that sometimes you go on a certain track and then you realize you have to come back. But I'd be a strong advocate for this leading to better decisions. And also, I just would like to say that just having mentioned that nothing in organizational or network development is a straight line, so that also we're seeing, I think now also transformational processes and organizations, certainly including Oxfam, that look at that complexity and basically that then also pull out where is it not just complex, but it's complicated. Where is it actually complex to a degree that we can't justify the transaction cost? And Oxfam, for example, now is in a very interesting process to also look at its operating model, which the way it is at the moment, again, it was agreed at that time when management of country operations came under Oxfam International, but there were other parts of the system that couldn't transform at the same speed. So now the next phase of the transition, but one that's again looking at really empowering the staff that do the work, the people that we're doing the work with and doing the work for, to actually say, no, this is actually the complexity has left us in a space where the transaction cost is too high. We need to free up those resources, be they time or be they creativity or be they money, to deliver on our vision, mission, and values. And
I'm glad
complex change processes, but also happening. So I think we shouldn't be too caught up again in what could go wrong, but also really I think the organizations like Oxfam are increasingly looking to seize those opportunities and doing the hard work, because as we said, it's not without pain. No. It is hard work.
No. I'm glad to hear that.
Challenging yourself. But as long as you have that common sense of belonging to the vision, the mission, the values, I think that then provides an important framework also that enables decision making where different positions and different needs and interests can be talked about and can be acknowledged, but also the people have that readiness to move forward together, even if it means for them that maybe they have to let go of something because they know they will ultimately gain something else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, that makes a lot of sense. Gosh, there's so much more that I had in mind to ask you and we cannot. So I'm going to make an abrupt pivot. I've asked you a bunch of questions that have been on my mind for a long time, frankly. And I'm really grateful for the candor and again, the I don't know how to say this in English, the multiple layers of the answers that you've given me. I also want to acknowledge that I really admire the way you have navigated an incredibly complex role in a very, by now it's an overused word in this interview, complex organization. So where should people go, Doris, during this year-ish of you resting, learning, and volunteering? Where should people go to find out more about you and to connect with you?
While I'm taking this break of some sort, it has probably come across, I haven't lost my passion, I haven't lost my professional curiosity, and these are just such important and amazing questions, and the opportunity to work through them with others. Same as Oxfam, it was never just me. There was always a fantastic team behind whatever I was involved with. But indeed, I can no longer be found through an organizational email address. I think the best way is to track me down on LinkedIn.
Okay.
And to then connect with me, send me a message. I'm also happy to share my email address, which is doris.basler@outlook.com. But if that's too hard, then just for people to find me on LinkedIn and to connect in that way, I think is
okay.
best.
Then we will put both the LinkedIn URL and your email with your permission in the show notes. And I now realize, Doris, that I actually have mispronounced your last name at the beginning of the interview, and I apologize for that. Thank you so much.
German umlaut, which
I know
safely ignored.
I had lost sight of that. So thank you so much, Doris, for this incredible wealth of experiences. I don't know how to call it, conceptual or analytical topic, but it's so important, and I don't think it's boring at all. So thank you also, listeners, for listening in on our conversation. If you found this podcast episode stimulating, then be sure to check out some of the other episodes in my podcast. You find these not just on my website, of course, 5oaksconsulting.org with the number 5, but also on my YouTube channel. Subscribe to my email list, and you'll always be the first to be in the know. And I also, before I finish up, I want to draw your attention to a somewhat provocative blog post about this exact topic of the implications of choices of organizational structures in the nonprofit and NGO sector on my website. And it has the title, When We Admire Decentralized Power in Other NGOs but Struggle with It in Our Own. And that blog post I wrote a while ago, based on the very interesting research by Long Chan, a junior academic here in the US. I will link to it in the show notes. And with that, this is Tosca, and I look forward to spending more time with you on NGO, Soul, and Strategy next time. Thanks for listening to my podcast. If you valued the content, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so that other leaders of social change organizations can find it too. And if you want to learn more, have a look at my website, 5oaksconsulting.org, where you will find blog posts, recordings of interviews with me, as well as information about my co-authored book, Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs. If you sign up for my email list, you will receive a free sneak peek at the book. Or feel free to email me at tosca@5oaksconsulting.org or contact me through my website. And follow me on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Till we talk again at NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye.